Marieke Alcoholic, it's a great honor and privilege to be here and to interview Joan S. But before I start, I have to read this little adage. This tape is produced for the Mid-Southern California Area Archives and as such will not be reproduced for other uses. This tape will remain in the custody of the Mid-Southern California Area Archives. In the interest of anonymity, we ask that no last names be stated. Do I have your permission, Joan, to tape this interview? I can't hear you. Joan?
I forgot I was muted.
Oh, do I have your permission to tape this interview?
Yes, you sure do.
Okay, please state your first name and sobriety date.
Okay, I'm Joan. I'm an alcoholic, and the date of my last drink is June 15th, 1957.
Thank you, Joan. It's an honor and privilege to be with you here today. Your last drink was 63 years ago. Things must have been very different for women alcoholics back then. Could you describe for us the climate at the time for women alcoholics seeking recovery?
Well, in the 50s, it certainly was different. One of the biggest things was the way, compared to where it is now, as far as the way you dress. I mean, it was totally, you wouldn't believe it, those of you who are younger, but I mean, the men would wear shirts, coats and ties, and the women all wore dresses and high heels. That was just normal for society in the 50s, you know. And so you had to dress up all the time. And, but the majority of meetings were men, and I was quite used to that. I mean, that didn't seem to bother me personally or anything, but it's men just ran everything. They were, we had speaker meetings that were like from always from 8:30 to 10, and most always the men led the meetings, or they were men speakers, and once in a while you got a woman speaker, and it was just kind of like that. I didn't notice anything that was really all that bad in the area that I was in, just that there weren't so many women, but you couldn't hardly tell sometimes, because sometimes the wives came of the men alcoholics, so there were women present. You really didn't notice it quite that much.
What type of support did you receive coming into the doors? Was it different for men than women, or what type of support? How did they reach out to you?
Well, the thing of it was, I didn't come in the doors as an alcoholic. So I came in differently. You know, if you want to know a little bit of background.
How did you come into AA?
How did I come in? Well, I come in the side door. I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous because I had a drinking problem. My mother had called me. They said she would die during the night. She was that chronic and alcoholic. And then she called me in a couple of months and she said, would you like to go to a meeting with me to see what helped her? And so that's how I got into my very first meeting. I went to see what got my mother sober, which I couldn't hardly believe that. And I didn't know, I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a mother problem, a grandfather problem. They were drunks. They were drunks. They're terrible, terrible people. But see, I had problems. They didn't have any problems. They were old. My mother was 42. My grandfather was 65. I mean, they were old, you know, and I have all these problems. There's two-legged problems, you know, things like that. But that's how I got in. And so it took me a year of being here. I was But they told me, the women that told me, said, keep coming back. And I thought they liked me. I didn't know you say it to everybody. So, but that's what brought me back. And I just thought, well, I found, see, it's hard to make a short story out of it, but I had been left with four children. The oldest one at that time was 6 years old. And when my mother asked me to go to a meeting, I thought to myself, well, I hadn't been out of the house for 7 years. So that's why I went to the meeting. I wanted to get out of the house. And, but she had no idea. And I know it's the truth. She had no idea that I had a drinking problem whatsoever. And I certainly didn't know that. And alcohol was a solution. I used alcohol as a solution to get here. So eventually, you know, I got here.
In our discussions, you mentioned that your first meeting was Arroyo Seco in Pasadena.
That is where my mother took me the very first time. Right?
And what, were there a lot of meetings back then in Pasadena? How was it?
I would say there were probably two in Pasadena that time. I think the Villa Street meeting was probably the original one, if I'm not mistaken. But in every city, there was a meeting every night. You know, if you said to somebody, well, I'll see you on Friday, then you knew where you were going. It was like that. There wasn't a lot of meetings. But you could find one every night, but not in the same city. And that's just the way it was, you know.
Did they go out for coffee afterwards like we do? Was there fellowshipping?
Not for me, because I had to go home.
Oh, right.
I couldn't do those things. And sometimes they'd pick me up to bring me. Even if I was drinking, they'd take me. Nobody ever said anything about that. They were afraid I was going to die. See, in those days, what you worried about mostly was people dying. You know, it wasn't how old they were or anything about it. They just, you come to Alcoholics Anonymous because you're going to die. That's the way it was. If you drink, you die. And that was very, very, very serious and to everybody. And that's the way they took me. And I was a long way from that, but I don't know how long it would have taken me to get to that point. But they was afraid I was going to die. They said I was the oldest. When I had my last drink, I was 25 years old.
What happened, Jones?
Somebody talking to me or not?
No, go ahead.
They muted themselves, I see. But I don't know what I was saying, nothing.
You were saying that your last drink was, you were 25 when you got sober.
Right, right. So, but see, I was so young and I had a whole a list of reasons that I couldn't be an alcoholic, and being too young was one of them, because the people in those days, they were like 45, 50 years old. And so being too young was one of the things that I hadn't done all these things that these women, that once did come to talk and things like that, they talked about. I had a woman there, she talked about, she got arrested 85 times on the corner of 5th and Town in Los Angeles. I didn't, you know, kind of relate to that. So I had another woman who became a good friend of mine, but she was married 8 or 9 times. And one of her husbands was one of Al Capone's men. Well, I didn't relate to that either, but, I listened for the differences. I listened, and then they become the differences, and then I'm out, you know. And one of the things is, I'm not Irish, I'm not Catholic. How can you be an alcoholic, you know? So I listened for all that time until one night, it was my last drink on June 15th, 1957. We don't know why it was my last drink, but
it was.
It was.
And you shared with me in our conversation previously that Your sponsor was Sybil C., the first woman west of the Mississippi to maintain sobriety. How did you meet Sybil?
Well, it was kind of, she was in Los Angeles and I'm in the San Gabriel Valley, which Arcadia was my home group. And so you didn't really travel. Somebody's got their mic open. Anyway, you didn't really travel a lot, you know, and I couldn't travel a lot. And, but like when my home group, you don't know last names, but Norm A. was in my home group, and he was there 3 years before myself. So we got to be instant friends because he was young also. And so we were the two kids, and we would go across town. We'd meet people. That way they'd ask us to speak here and there, whatever. And this, in some way or other, we met her. She was a secretary of the central office for about 12 years in Los Angeles. Anyway, she'd come out to our women's group that we had in San Gabriel, and that's how I really got more acquainted with her. And from then on, we were just like connected at the hip. We just got attached, and so that's kind of how we met.
Could you tell me what were her immediate suggestions?
Well, it was kind of hard to make a lot of suggestions. I couldn't really change what I had. I couldn't change my circumstance. I couldn't change anything, you know. And but the fact that I had to learn how to talk. I had to learn how to communicate. I had to learn how to tell people about myself or what was bothering me, because that was very, very, very hard. Very, very hard, because I always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. And so I had all these things from my earliest memory, whether it was 2 years old or whatever, always felt this way. You can't talk about yourself. I never heard anybody talk about themselves. But to read the book, Go to Meetings and Don't Drink, that was a mainstay.
That was the mainstay, huh?
That was a mainstay right there. And I still say that. I mean, you know, as long as you don't drink and don't give up. I found a new
don't give up.
Somebody I latched onto in a meeting, a newcomer. Don't give up. Just don't give up. Because I won't go into what somebody called me the other day. He was drunk. And, I don't think he gave up. I said, if you'd called me before you drank, I'd have talked to you all day. But I'm not going to spend my whole day listening to you argue with me.
Right.
While you're drinking. I did listen for 15 minutes. And then I just hung up. What can you do when somebody's already drinking?
So drawing on that, on your vast experience, strength, and hope, what indispensable actions are needed to achieve and maintain sobriety today? Has it changed or is it the same?
Not in my book. It's just what I got through saying. I think, this program is so simple, but it's for complicated people. And we complicate it all, makes it too hard. It isn't really that hard. You know, of course, you couldn't have told me that then. I'm telling you now, I can tell you a lot of things about myself now that I understand. I understand everything that people were trying to tell me a long time. I couldn't get it, but I didn't drink. And I was obnoxious. I was sarcastic. I was a pain in the neck. I did service work begrudgingly in the group. And I was just whatever. And then as I tell people, usually I get through that service work, they made me stay sober. And I didn't even want to. I said, I can't stay sober. You know, with all my problems, I've got four little babies. The oldest one by that time was 7 years old. The youngest one was two. And I got problems. And so, but then by the time I get to be a year old, after then making me do all the service work in a group, and I'm going to drink when it's over, then elected me as a secretary to a meeting. See, well, there you are, the whole different world. You know, now Alcoholics Anonymous needs me, and now I'm important. I don't care why anybody stays sober. Just so, you know, it'll pass. That won't last too long. But I mean, it just sometimes some of these new people are a little obnoxious. Now, I wonder why I recognize that. I recognize it more anybody else does. Because I know what they're thinking. They ain't thinking is what the matter.
Right.
They should stop thinking.
But you keep coming back.
Absolutely. And what's the difference now? You read the book, Go to Meetings and Don't Drink. That's the mainstay right there. That's right. A combination that's you can't beat that.
Right.
That doesn't mean you stay that way, but I'm just saying that's what sometimes in a day when you're newer or even in times of crises or whatever going on, that may be the only thing you think of. I mean, I don't say, well, I have every 5 minutes I'm praying. I mean, I just don't do that. But there are times that just you can't think. You can't think of how to solve this or what to do or who to call. So the main thing, no matter what, you just don't give up. Tomorrow will be different. Not better, but different. Tomorrow will be different.
That's amazing hope. That's amazing hope. So how do you keep your program vital and new now?
Well, that's my story right now. Now, I love to talk about now. I love to tell you about all my trials and tribulations and drag out all those things. And everybody will cry. If I cry, they'll cry. So I don't cry. Where I am now, Trish, you know. Anyway, what happened? Can I take about a couple of minutes to just to?
You have 25 minutes to go.
Oh well,
we've got time.
Oh yeah. Good. Okay. Well, my now kind of started a year and a half ago to get me where I am now. So a year before March, when this all came down on us, this shutdown, the year before. That March of whatever year that was, 19. I got sick, and I'd never been sick. And all the times I've been sober, never took medicine, don't mess with doctors, nothing. All of a sudden, I can't talk when I stand up, and I can't, you know, breathe, things like that. Well, that's kind of a bother. And so I had to cancel all the stuff I was doing. I was very active and speaking and doing all these things and taking a plane to go to talk to her. I couldn't do that anymore. So, well, that's okay. That was okay. I didn't have any problem with accepting that because I don't have to do those things. Somebody else could do that. I have to go to a meeting and be with my friends. That's where I was for a year. I got to meetings. I drove. I could drive. I just didn't stand up much. So anyway, so a lot of people didn't even know. They just probably wondered why I was sitting down all the time. But anyway, that happened. And then this March came. And all of a sudden, there was no meetings. Wham! I was meeting Thursday night, and the next day it's shut down. And that's when I found out through this fact that I'm elderly. I didn't know that. You think about it. How many times any of you talk about how old somebody is? You don't talk about that. But all of a sudden, I'm older, elderly. So here I am, elderly, and my lungs are gone, and I can't do this, that, and the other. Nobody comes see me. I can't go anyplace. Can't do anything, but I can drive the car to the grocery store, which I'm still doing. Anyway, so to see what happened at that point was my friends begged me, insisted, whatever, said, I've got to learn Zoom. I said, I can't do that. Yeah, I can't be taught. I'm technically challenged. I can even barely use my phone. But they insisted, said, you must show up at meetings. You have to show your face. You have to go to meetings. These are men telling me this. And so anyway, the short story of that was this friend who's in Orange County and I'm in San Diego, and he gets on the phone with his phone and my phone. I started out on the phone anyway, and we spent hour after hour and another day and whatever. He taught me how to do the Zoom. And so pretty soon I'm going to the meeting that I was going to before. I'm going to this meeting over here, and I'm a happy camper. I can see my friends now because I haven't seen anybody. So now I can see my friends. Well, how that turned out to where I am today is that I heard that Bill was speaking in Australia and they gave me the numbers. And so I went to hear Bill. Well, then pretty soon my friend June's going to be speaking in Texas. So they give me the numbers and I went to hear her. Pretty soon I'm showing up at all these places. And I'm following my friends who are speakers and doing all this stuff. And where are you going next? Tell me where you're going to go next. So I'll go where you go. And then people sending me flyers and all this stuff. And on a workshop, oh, I know that one. I'm going to go in there and hear this one because I know this one. And that's how it started. Then all of a sudden, just for one example, not only that, but circumstance made me have to get a laptop. I got a laptop. I can see 25 people at one time instead of one. I really think that coincidentally at that time, I think is when I really went skyrocketing, because all of a sudden I'm sitting up, you know, I'm really getting excited and enjoying this thing, you know? And so one example was I was in a meeting in Las Vegas and this guy up there, I won't say his name probably right. His name is Israel. And I don't really know or anything. And so I'm watching this speaker at this meeting, and I get a text from Israel, who's leading the meeting. And so he says, will you speak for me in Jerusalem tomorrow morning? And I said, well, I'm in the meeting where you are. Anyway, that's how it started. Every place I went, I was getting stuff like that. And I don't understand what happened. You know, I don't understand what happened.
That's incredible.
I mean, that's kind of why my name keeps passed around, but you know, I know what it is. People are getting people that they couldn't get before because you couldn't drive that far to a speaker meeting. I'm going to a women's conference in New York in a couple of weeks. I mean, you know, stuff like that. It's just, well, that's where I'm at right now.
That's amazing.
I'm so enthused and so on fire, kind of, you know.
Things are fresher now more than ever after 63 years.
It's the best ever. I'm getting younger, you know, and I did this once before. I've told people when I was 65 years old, I was very old, and something happened. And I got really young again. So here I am doing it again. I can't do this very many times, you know. I mean, I'm 88, so there's gotta be some kind of a limit, but I'm sitting here. I just got to keep showing up. That's all I do now is I show up, and I go to meetings all the time. You invited me here. But I go to meetings. I'll be at a meeting tonight. So, you know what I'm saying? I've got a whole new life, a whole new life. I never would have thought. And so I'm just going to stay here as long as people will invite me, but I also can go on my own. I don't have to be invited someplace.
And all that is born because you had the tenacity to always show up. There you go.
I was on a mission before this happened. Of people with like for 30 years and over, I was talking about complacency because I was already on that. some people, you've seen it happen. You know it happens. That people, it shocks me, really, but it doesn't really. So I was already, and I told them, don't count if you don't show up at meetings. I don't care how long you've been sober. If you don't sit, get in the meeting, you don't count. Length of time. Don't give me this stuff, So they see me at sobriety countdowns. I'm a big joke in the San Diego County, Well, I walk in, they said, well, we know who's got it today, And but that's okay. I show up, and
that's awesome. That's awesome. When in your sobriety did you start to work with others, and how did that work for you?
Well, that's interesting. The first 12-step call I went on was 6 months before I got sober, and we got drunk together. Well, that's when I started. But now, since then, I've done it a little differently. And I had a business in my home, and I sponsored a lot of women. They come in and out, and I sponsored them that way for a number of years. And people ask me to sponsor them when their sponsor dies. So I inherit people. And sometimes it's a man will ask me, and it's such a thrill. I've had maybe half a dozen in my life, and this last one I guess was the most wonderful thing. Was I don't know if you don't mind if I just say this, his name Cliff Roach, and he asked me, and I just was just thrilled. I said, and I'd known him all these years, and we went to the same home group and all this stuff, and I knew he knew he was dying, and so for 2 or 3 years. He just needed somebody else. Somebody was sober longer than him, which was hard to find, because he was in his 40, well, I can't remember, 46, 47, 48, something in there. And that was the greatest thrill. But now, so I have about three women, 34, 35, 36 years sober. But one of them is really tight, is that she used to come once a week and an hour or two, each time, whatever work schedule permitted. And so, but now I haven't seen her since March, but she's got Zoom, which she uses in her work. So now the same day, we whatever time she says, can you see me in 5 minutes? Can you see me at 4 o'clock? And I said, no problem. I'm there sitting there. So we get on the Zoom and we talk about whomever. And I talk about my stuff and she talks about her stuff. And we just, she just thinks I walk on the water, 34 years sober. I just love it. I mean, I feel like I'm of some help, some use, and being of service. Doing this is, I know that's another kind of service, but I always knew showing up at meetings I was being of service. Just going to a meeting and, there's all kinds of ways. I can't do the physical stuff.
Right.
I don't do the greeting at the door. I had to stop that because I stand up and it's cold at the door. But there's certain things.
Service keeps you young in the program.
I used to pass the basket. I want that job, so I would do that. I could do that. Now that's a little much. So,
okay. Who, if anyone in the program, most influenced your recovery?
Well, it would be different parts, but right now I've known this one man is in service, and known him for many years. He's sober like 46 years, I think, but I've known him probably 35 or so years, and gradually he is just the epitome of service. And you would maybe know who it was, but anyway, we go to the same home group, and he's somebody I could always count on. And it's where I learned the term road dog. Anyway, he would introduce me. He said, this is my road dog. And I go to meetings with him when he would do he does talks on the steps, traditions, concepts, and all over, and I just love to go watch it. I can't do that, but he does that. And so stuff like that, and just gradual thing. And then he wanted me to write a story, and he came over one day and he just started. I said, you're taking my inventory. I said, yeah, that's kind of what you're doing. So we were doing. So, I mean, I trust him. I've learned to trust him with everything. And we don't do the sponsor type thing and talk, but that's what he's a sponsor to me. He really is. And a funny little story, I don't think it'd take but a minute, is something happened. We're seen together a lot, and everybody knows he looks after me. And he does it in his own way. They know we sit together, me. And some way somebody misunderstood that, and they had the sponsorship turned around, you know, probably because of Cliff. And I was speaking at a meeting one time, and all these guys showed up, and they're well-known speakers and all, and they've got 17 sponsees with them, and they started referring to, I was their great, great, great grand sponsor, some foolish thing. And I thought, what are they talking about? Well, and Paul's sitting right there, I didn't know what to say. Yeah, I know they got it mixed up. He just laughed. I laughed. And they do that. He said, I don't know what I'm going to do if they want to ask me about my sponsor, Joan. I said, well, I wondered about that myself. But we're not saying anything because they're having so much fun with it. They think I sponsored the world, you know. And so it's harmless, but they're having a lot of fun. But,
I hang
with the right people is what I'm telling you.
Was there anyone outside of AA who influenced your recovery?
Outside, I really don't know. Maybe some of my jobs and things like that, but I mean, that was just experience that I had, but I wouldn't say that anything outside that I can think of right now.
Okay. And, a little back to the past, what was being of service different in the 50s and 60s than it is now? What was expected of you?
Well, I tried, I think it's not in the 50s so much as maybe the 60s, like general service, try to get involved in that. But these are all, and see, I didn't have any education. I left school, walked out of school, and didn't have any formal education, and I was married at 17 and all that stuff. I never went out of the house. I don't know anything. So all the language I'm hearing is in AA. You know, I think AA invented everything. I even thought it invented Zoom. I found out somebody said, no, it's been in existence a long time. But general service, it was all men, and they're talking in this language that I understand. It's just a very adult, mature business language that I don't know anything about. I don't know anything about business language and all that. It was just a little too heavy. It was heavy. General service was heavy. I got in the central office stuff, and that was a little bit easier, but I wasn't able to do it for a long time, to do that kind of stuff, be free that much.
Right. And how was 12-step work done in the 60s, 70s? Because now it seems mostly the recovery homes, you know, the rehabs are doing the 12-step work. How was it when you were coming up?
Well, I'm sure you well know that there weren't any recovery homes at all. No recovery homes at all when I was there. There was a woman's recovery home and a friendly house in Los Angeles. There was a men's recovery home in San Bernardino called Miller's. That was it. That's the only type of recovery other than sanitariums, hospitals, and jail. And because originally people were brought from hospitals to meetings, and originally people didn't walk into a meeting, they were brought into a meeting, you know. And so in that regard, it's changed somewhat. But I mean, when I was able to do some 12-step work, because they'd come and get me and I'd go with me, go in pairs, you know. And somebody called central office in Los Angeles. And I'm in the San Gabriel Valley. That's there wasn't anything else, just a Los Angeles central office. And they have a list, and they'd call somebody, and they'd call whoever's available. And so they'd call me or call somebody else, and then they'd call me to go with them, things like that. And we'd make this call together. And it was all very strictly, you know, women call on women and men call on men and all this. I had a man one time called on me. Just because my family was getting desperate because I was going to meetings and being drunk and my kids and all this stuff. And they sent him over, and I knew who he was later. And my friend Norm, it was my friend Norm's sponsor is who it was. And so, but now it doesn't, it's so different now, but they used to get calls, 12-step calls.
Right.
But I was limited with all these small children and everything. I was limited to times and things like that, you know.
Right. What was your spiritual life before you got sober, and how has it changed over the years?
Oh my, I didn't even know one before I got here. And I don't know why that is. I have a sister that's a year younger than myself. I still have a sister. And we were raised together in the same home. My parents were divorced when I was 4 years old. So my mother raised both of us the same. And yet at 10 years old, my sister went towards the church. I went down where they were playing basketball. And then I went in and up here. You know what I'm saying? My sister's an ordained minister. My son is an ordained minister. I don't know what happened to me. What I'm saying is, I don't know that's in them. I didn't have any trouble understanding that part. My son is never had a problem. He's had physical problems. He's very disabled in different ways, and that's another story. But my sister, I've never said an unkind word about her to anybody ever, I'm sure. She's like a saint. She's just that kind. I didn't have a problem with that. What I thought was that God only looked after good people, and I was bad. It was a good and bad thing. I don't know where I got that, but I was always bad. That's what I thought of myself. I was bad. I said bad things to people. I was rude to people. I hurt people's feelings. When as a small child, I did that on purpose. I was bad. Not like maybe it is now, but I mean, that was bad, bad, you know. And so now it took a lot of years to get, I don't even know how to call things spiritual. I don't use the language like that. I really don't. It doesn't compute. But I know that my thinking is a much different plane now. And I know I think I don't have any unkind words towards other people. And that expression, I really know what it means. It's one of the hard ones for me, only on one occasion, but I won't talk about that, is that what people think about me is none of my business. That is a big help, you know. That takes a lot of weight off of you, you know. And, but this is, I just don't relate to talking about spiritual things to me. And yet I know that somebody else might describe me that way because they know me and they know what I do. But I don't think that way. I'm a better person than I used to be, you know.
Okay.
Because of this program. Yeah. I think different, I talk different, I treat people differently.
At what point in your recovery did you work the steps?
Well, you know, technically I learned, like I said in the beginning, it was just like read the book, go to meetings and don't drink. We didn't have the step things and didn't, like they talk about, I wish I did had that, but they didn't do that. They didn't sit down and do steps and steps. We just kind of, if you want what I have, do what I do. You just do what the other people do, you know, and you don't really sit down. Where I've learned most about doing the steps is when I'm working with other people in the last, you know, in the last say 20 years in that era, because, we just go over the book together. We do things like, but I never did that before. You know, I just read the book or whenever it's appropriate, read certain sections or whatever. But I never had any groups, no studies, no study groups, only speaker meetings, 8:30 to 10 at night. And that was all. I had no daytime meetings, you know.
That's really interesting. And do you have any, two things. Do you have any words of hope and direction for the newcomer? Or the middle timer, for all of us.
Well, I'll tell you, there was this point. I always think of him and Father Terry. I always think about him because at one point when I first started getting out, getting loose, my kids are gone, all that stuff. I think I was sober about 15 years, and I told the story. He was there one time, and I'd met him before, but I was telling about my story then, which many things I haven't even told you. Well, nothing hardly at all. And he came up to me after, he says, you know, in there is a little bit of hope, you know, and it's just because no matter what happened in there, I was still sober. You know, it was a lot of heavy stuff. And so just my story is enough to tell people to have hope. I mean, like I said, don't give up. And I can, unless you hear somebody's really the tragic, all the drama and all this stuff, and you know what people really went through. And well, if I, you know, she can do that, I can do that. Well, you have to know that stuff. You just have to know we all have. We've all been through things that are See, God only gives you what you can handle each day. And I used to say, I think God made a mistake. He got, give it to the wrong person, you know, it's too much. And, but you see, you don't drink. And that's, to me, that's hope to other people. The fact that I've been sober this long, I surely had to go through a bunch of stuff, you know. Absolutely. This one dies, you know, all the different things that happen to you, you know. People just know that.
Okay, and one last thing. Is there anything that I haven't covered that you would like to address?
No, I just think it's important for me to share where I am now and what's happened to me in this life that I'm in this last year, and then especially this last year, the 6 months, that no matter what, there's a purpose. There's a purpose for me. You told me that in last March. I was telling no. You know, I'm going to be stuck in this house all by myself and won't see anybody. It lasted one day, but I'm just, you know, it's just, that's what I want people to know, that no matter what, you don't drink, no matter what, do the next indicated thing, show up at Zoom. No excuse not to go to Zoom. Now, there's an excuse not to go to a live meeting. I choose not to, I can't go to a live meeting. I'm asking already as far as November and January. And I said, as long as it's not a live meeting, I don't want to sign up for those yet. Whether I ever will, I don't know. I'll be able to do that, you know, don't know.
So thank you so very much for being with us today. We are profoundly grateful.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll bring it back over